It's Wednesday, October 22nd, 2008, and you're listening to episode 120 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 58 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
I'm Pat.
I'm John.
And I'm Chad.
And just in case anyone doesn't remember, 119 and 120 are recorded back-to-back, which is why I still sound like crap. Hopefully by the time 121 drops, I will be back to my normal voice. In the meantime, we've got some big changes here around the mics. Instead of milk duds, I've got gobstoppers. Per our agreement in last episode.
I'm a gobstopper, huh? I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
Chad has the screwdriver.
Yes, the thrifty, did you get this at a dollar store?
I have no idea where it came from. It still stabs,
so that's what...
It stabs and it screws. Yeah. What else do you need in life?
This brown... never mind.
All right, Worldwide Wing Night 5, just once again, November 8th, Saturday. If you are not in the St. Louis area, there are
get here.
But also, there are people on our forums that have started a running list of Worldwide Wing Night events in other cities. I will link that thread off the show notes. So if you're not in St. Louis, then you can use that thread to try and see if Chad just hit John with the screwdriver.
But I'm wearing the helmet, so yeah. I didn't even feel it.
So there you go.
That's awesome.
So if you're not in the St. Louis area and can't make it to the St. Louis area, that's your way of finding a Worldwide Wing Night event near you. Fear the Con 2 is coming up.
Oh my God, is it?
Yes, if, once again.
Two for 2 days. So is this like a new thing? Like we Fear the Con 3 is 3 days. Fear the Con 47 is just like...
I don't know. We'll see.
Well, on the one hand, I'd say, haha, yeah. On the other hand, we did get to episode 100. So Fear the Con. Outlandish promises have come true before.
Well, it is going to be Fear the Con 2 by 2 by 2 because it's Fear the Con 2 on two floors of a building over 2 days.
Oh my God.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Volunteers, so, if you'd like to sign up to be a volunteer, then head out to the forums. I'll have a thread started in the Fear the Con 2 forum.
Right. And be sure to go out and check the website, www.warhorn.net. And if you can't understand that through my laryngitis,
www.warhorn.net.
/Fear the Con. Sign up should be up by the time this drops. If not, then I'll have a note on there explaining why. Also, something else that we are going to start doing that should be up by the time this episode's out, because actually it's almost...
One-arm push-ups.
That's right. Unicron's doing one right now.
He is. That's amazing, because apparently Unicron... Well, we mistakenly thought Unicron that watches over us fell over, but no, he's like leaning over and he's on one arm, and it looks like he's doing a one-arm push-up.
Lifting a whole planet on one arm. But if you go to feartheboot.com, there is a little link that's been there for a while. It's kind of rectangularly shaped, the Sphere of the Boot RPG podcast, but for several weeks it hasn't gone anywhere. We have created a blog, and that is going to be the new location of the Fear the Boot RSS feed. I'm going to put all the updates in there, so your podcatcher should catch the new RSS feed on its own. If it doesn't, you can actually keep going to Libsyn, because I don't want to move the files, because if I do... Your podcatcher, or at least many of them, will see those as new locations, sync their new files, and you will get our entire back catalog all over again.
So in the end, just to keep this simple, people who get this show on an RSS feed don't have to do anything.
Well, they might lose show notes. So they actually take that back. They will lose the RSS feed because all I'm going to be putting there is the media files. So your podcatcher should take care of this on its own. If it does not... Go to feartheboot.com, click on the Fear the Boot link, and that will take you to the new blog, the new RSS feed. But we're not just going to be putting the shows on there. We are going to be using that blog to start posting articles just about the kind of games we're running, stuff we're reading, stuff we're doing. I'm going to try to get some guests to come on there and write some articles as well.
I have some contributors lined up, so we'll see if this kind of took longer than we anticipated, so I have to recheck and see if the contributors are still interested.
But the blog's up and it's ready to go. So if you're interested in a little bit of geekdom throughout the week outside of the episodes, go to feartheboot.com, click the Fear the Boot link, and that will take you right to that blog. Something else that we've got cooking up.
Warhammer Online Guild is really awesome and growing by the minute.
Yeah, but I was going to give that a rest this episode.
No.
Something brand new to announce that we have going on. Actually, Chad reminded me of before we started recording this.
Because I threatened you with a screwdriver?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right now, Chris Hussey is working with an artist, and I would get him to comment on this personally, except Chris Hussey's not here because he's a big bitch.
Yeah. So, you know, spending time with his wife and family. It's,
Actually, I don't know what he's doing today.
I thought he said he was spending time with in-laws or family. And, well, anything he does is either work, podcasting, or family. So.
Right. So, outside of podcasting, it's all stupid. But Chris Hussey is right now working with an artist to deliver what another webcomic to the Fear the Boot page. This
Chainmail Bikini 2?
No, we've decided this time we're going to be different. We are not going to do a comedic comic. We're going to do a dramatic comic. Chris Hussey is going to be writing it, and it is going to be set in Skies of Glass. Whenever he's on next, I will let him provide an update for you guys, along with the details, whatever details he's ready to give on what that story is going to be about. But that's something I'm really looking forward to, because I've seen some of the previews of the scripts.
Isn't going to be the guys sitting around a table and the comic is about the game they're playing, ha ha ha, it's Skies of Glass. No, this is a dramatic comic set in the Skies of Glass universe.
Set in a post-nuke world.
Right.
Third and final episode here of our little mini-series.
I won!
I know, that's why you have the screwdriver.
Yes!
On roles within a party, and we're now hitting the last topic, which is the leader role. Obviously, leader's not a class, so I don't think we have to struggle with our...
I think in some games it is. Some of the story stick and sort of indie games, I understand.
Well, right, but...
That's normal games.
Right, for example, it's not like in D&D you can roll up a 5th level leader.
Yeah.
It's not like...
Paladins are supposed to lead.
In Star Trek, you have a captain, but the captain can, at least in the fast version, can come from any number of schools. So I realize there may be role-playing games where the mechanic requires a leader who has different stats and abilities. But in the majority of role-playing games, the leader is a metagame concept, that there's somebody who is in charge of the party or who makes the final decision on stuck votes or whatever, that has nothing to do with the normal mechanic of creating characters. So let's start with, why have a leader in a party?
Well, is it a conscious choice? I think let's get rid of the military games where you, well, he's the lieutenant or he's the captain.
I'd say keep those in there, because I think that's just as relevant. But I do think you're making an important distinction there, which is there are two kinds of leaders. I mean, when I was going through high school and college, I took a bunch of psychology classes. And I couldn't coach the case studies, but they did studies where they would take 100 people, lock them in a room, and leave them there for a long period of time. And invariably, they would...
That sounds like school itself.
Well, the invariable outcome is that a social order emerges. You know, if you work at a job...
In the experiment, a pig head gets put on a pike. So.
if you work a job and you've ever been put on a team, invariably, somebody kind of moves to the forefront and everyone sort of takes on these roles. If you're not that far along in life, you're still at school, guess what? When your teacher puts you off into groups of five to do a school project, there's always somebody who ends up doing most of the talking.
And there's always somebody
most
who's
of the work.
Yeah, maybe most of the work. And there's always somebody who just kind of tags along. And so there's that implicit leader that is going to emerge. We definitely want to talk about that. But then in some games, there also may be an explicit leader, one who drops the F-bomb a lot.
That's me. Yeah.
But I mean, a leader who specifically has to be the leader, because it's a military game. It's a Star Trek game. It's you're playing on a kingdom in D&D and somebody's got to be the king or queen.
Right.
And so there is someone who absolutely has some kind of authority over the other members of the party.
What are you looking at?
I'm sorry, that helmet's just outrageous.
Okay, I thought you were implying that I'm always the leader character. Which
you have a helmet and a red cape and big glasses.
This is my vestment. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Super John.
Yeah, that's right, I'm Super John. I'll lead your party. I'll lead your mom's party.
Oh.
All right, so yeah, leaders, they exist.
So which one do you guys want to tackle first? The implicit leaders or explicit leaders?
Let's go with the explicit leaders.
Actually, you know, so let's back up to the original question.
Okay.
Why have leaders at all? Now, in the case of an explicit leader, I think it's fairly obvious the game requires it. It's a military game and somebody's got to have the higher rank. But why have that role represented at all?
So that I can be the scheming second man who wants to kill him.
I think that you have a bunch of people at the table. I mean, there's the meta game out of game reason. You have a bunch of people at the table throwing out plans and ideas and saying we should do this, we should do that. eventually you just need one person to say, okay, we're doing this. Otherwise, it's just going to degrade into, well, how we talked about how we played when we were in high school. Whoever yells the loudest.
You know, I can
The Quaker consensus method decision-making process that takes four game sessions inside of 10 seconds of play.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually ends up in hurt feelings and because somebody has to get voted down. I can remember a great little allegory for this, which is the different guilds that we ran in World of Warcraft. The original guild I was in World of Warcraft was started by a group of myself and six of my friends, so seven total. And we decided that this was really going to be more of a council type thing.
Where
we
seven officers to command 20 people.
No. It was
I know it got bigger
by the time we were done. It was like 150 people. But still, what ended up happening was basically factionalizing and deadlock. And we could
Alpha Centauri.
We could never get anything done. Along these lines, and I think it's the Venus Prime series, Arthur C. Clarke's name's on it, but actually somebody else wrote it. They talk about psychological experiments that NASA did to see what happens when you put different numbers of people together. And basically what they found is that the more people you put together, the worse these things get. And so invariably, you have to create some kind of an order, a place where the buck stops to get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's always the case with all group of people, but I think it's always going to happen, partially out of necessity and partially because there's always going to be one person in the party who's just like, let's stop talking. I'm doing this.
Yeah. And that guy
wild
is
card.
That guy's beloved to game masters because it depends. He's either going to ruin the game or throw the game off the rails. But
either way, he's going to make something happen, which you can then manhandle into what you want to happen.
That is the key
only
right
thing
there.
That you cannot divert into the forward motion of the plot
inaction.
Is them talking out of character.
Yep. Inaction. I think that is the main reason why you need a leader. Either, you know, you're Captain James T. Kirk, or, you know, it's like everybody always listens to Bob. So Bob's the leader, is because the worst enemy to a game master after the game master gets all the adventure done, gets it to the table, gets everyone around the table, gets them to shut up and start playing. The number one enemy to game mastering is just apathy. It doesn't even have, it doesn't even have to be apathy. It could be the opposite of apathy.
It can be
over-planning.
Extremely calculated inaction.
Yeah.
Well,
there's an action nonetheless.
There's another enemy that frightens me equally, which is complete chaos.
Yeah.
Where you've got three people with three ideas, they're going three directions. And now what ends up happening is I have to conduct three games.
Well, no, you can't let that happen.
And that's, you know, that's boring for everyone because
someone just hits the right end of the screen and then the other person's at the left end of the screen and they can't go any farther.
Yep. You know what I do is as a game master is that, and I've had this happen lots of times, especially in the groups that I've played with it, because everybody is a real strong personality, is that I usually have a very strong character come out, an NPC, and assume very, very limited temporary leadership. Basically barking out orders like, okay, you guys go over there. And I don't make him powerful in the fact of, yeah, he could just kill you in an instant, but although I do that too, sometimes that's necessary. But I try and make him powerful in personality and voice and talking over everyone and make them outrageous big characters so that people are like, oh, we better listen to him. He's so outrageous. But
right. We've given reasons why leaders are helpful and maybe even necessary, but I wanted just to make sure I'm feeling out the opinions of everyone here. Is this a point that any of you are dogmatic on?
I like my groups to be asymmetric. I like someone to own the ship. I like someone to have the connection that got them the job. I like someone to be the hero of prophecy. Whatever. I find a level playing field boring. I am dogmatic on that. I am not dogmatic on having an explicit leader.
Yeah.
I'm not either.
I don't think that a game master, I don't like the idea of pointing at someone and saying you're the leader. And I've done that before and it doesn't work. I've never seen it work, or at least not well.
Right.
And I think that leadership is something that kind of develops. And as a game master, you might be able to kind of give somebody a little bit of authority over another and kind of help grow that.
And this is one of the biggest areas that your natural inclinations and your personality will manifest themselves in the character, no matter how you try to take a role-playing tack at it.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it's really difficult to be either bolder or more meek than you actually are.
Yeah.
You know, and also I think if you've got a game that does not require a leader just by the nature of the game, and you've got a party or a group of friends who can get along, who can come to decisions, who can work together without someone being the boss, then I would agree that it's not a necessary thing. It may be helpful. It creates order, you know, things we've been saying, but I don't think it's necessary either. So this is not something I'd be dogmatic on. Now, when the game requires a leader, or when the unfortunate social situation among your groups of friends requires the selection of leader,
in-game or out-of-game?
Either one.
So you have two super ninja guys who will absolutely contradict each other at every turn, and somebody somehow has to make them work together?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. I had this in my own games where, for years, I could predict that out of any given session, at least 2 hours of it would be spent with Mike and Tim bickering over something.
I see.
Well, that's because they did that in real life.
Precisely.
Game, once again, it goes back to
and
who
so
you
therefore,
actually are.
Yeah, it goes back to the party could not make a choice and move together. Now, that's very different than the dynamic of our Sunday group, where we seem to be pretty good about coming to consensus or at least going along with whoever just struck out and did something. So when you have to have a leader, how do you go about picking the person? Because here's the problems and the pitfalls that I have seen occur during that selection process.
Ego.
One. Okay.
Timidity.
Okay, you guys are moving faster than my list.
Okay.
One is ego. You pick someone, and who you pick, there's political capital involved in it. That somebody else is going to get their feelings hurt, or somebody else is going to think they're slighted, or they're going to think you're playing favorites. The second is timidity.
The only thing worse than picking your girlfriend, I suppose, is not picking your girlfriend, huh?
Yeah, precisely. The second could be timidity, that the person, you pick someone as leader, but they are so quiet, they are so non-active, that they are never going to stop any disputes
we
or make any decisions.
We had that game that you made me the leader
and
of.
And sometimes that can create some really neat role-playing situations, but other times it just grinds your game to a halt.
Yeah. I got a good character death out of it, which is, of course, what I always want.
The third possibility is the reverse of timidity, which is you get someone in there who is the obvious choice for leader because they're loud, they're bossy, they're commanding. And as a result, every single time you play Star Trek or Battletech or a Kingdom
in
D&D,
he's the captain, he's the lieutenant.
They're always the one in charge, because they just have that natural charisma, or their ego will get hurt if they're not. Or, I guess similar to the ego thing, kind of the reverse of that, is you have to pick somebody not because their ego will be hurt if they're not picked as captain, but because they have really, really porcelain feelings regarding being told what to do.
Oh, wham.
Some of those people get so bad that they would not only turn on a fellow player, they would turn on a game master.
Yeah,
and I've run Star Wars and had my players tell me, hey, when my level one Jedi uses the Force, it's going to be this cool. And I've told them, try that. I'll tell you what happens in game. Now that they didn't try it.
Okay, a player trying to usurp the GM. Now, that's a whole new level.
Well, I'm taking it to its idiotic extreme, but that exists, and I know what you're talking about.
Right, and I've had that within my games. There have been people in my games where I've had to be very careful on who I pick as leader, and oftentimes I have to default to this person, not because they insist on being leader, but because they cannot handle being told what to do by somebody else, especially if they disagree with the decision. But they do not like the idea of somebody else dictating their actions on any level.
They can be the wild card. There's always a wild card. It's either a slow, schemey wild card or a fill wild card, but it moves the game forward no matter what, and as Chad noted, that's really important.
Yeah.
What if you get Captain Power Tripper? And this is bad as a GM, but it's bad as a player too. I mean, we've all been in this game where the whole game is about how awesome the Baron is. And it could be Baron Von Badass or whoever. And the whole game just collapses into this wank about this one Marty Stew. How do you dislodge a player who has established himself in that position?
The bad leader can certainly come in that form. And I think we have seen it. School, work, whatever, the boss who's too overbearing, who's too bossy, who takes away the ability of the characters to do anything other than whatever it is he wants to do in the glory moments he wants to have.
Yeah. I mean, I have seen entire settings come alive with eyes and ears of the one Super Baron character. NPCs jump off the tracks to defend the Super Baron from any problems from the player characters, and it just makes the setting stupid.
I think a situation like this, it almost extends to beyond in-game, and it gets to a point where you're, you know, it's the interaction between the players themselves. And we sort of, we've talked about that in some of the previous, you know, the last four or five episodes of, like, you know, player problems. Because I think if you get to a situation that's that extreme where it's just a, you know, a one guy wank and everyone else is just not having a good time, it's like, yeah, you've got a problem in the game, and, you know, how are you going to address that? So, and I, yeah, fortunately I haven't had that really, but that would be a real problem, I think. And
some people's escape in role-playing games is to have this super egotistical adventure, and I've done it before and enjoyed it.
So I mean, as long as everybody else is cool with it, I mean, that's, you know, you're all, you're well and good. And so, and maybe, you know, maybe that is a group, but if it's just, if it's wearing on the other characters and it's just bad, then,
you know, I think there's a simple concept that would fix really both sides of the leadership problem, which is the leaders that don't do anything versus the leaders that micromanage and demand the spotlight all the time. John, how did you get the screwdriver?
No one knows. That's why I'm my character archetype. It's the flattering schemer.
He is sabotaging this episode.
No one is ever afraid of me. They're just suddenly dead.
Or screwed.
Indeed. Yeah.
But it's the idea of servant leadership. The idea that a leader is not the one that everyone works for, but rather he works for everyone through the job of bringing order and unity. That, you know, in a sense, the leader, yeah, he's on top, he makes the decisions, but he does so because he is desiring to bring order, unity, to keep people moving forward, that he's not there to exert his will upon them, but to rather to help them succeed.
So you ensure that the character has the sort of paladin bent, or perhaps that the player is a naturally consensus-forming and attentive leader.
Right, who's not afraid to throw down his opinion, who's not afraid to cast the tie-breaking vote, who's not afraid to say, okay, guys, let's stop discussion, move forward, but does it with the spirit of, I am doing this for the sake of the party and the game, not because...
at least takes care to appear that he has popular consent.
Right, and is not doing it simply to get his rocks off on the fact that he's now able to bend three or four other people to his every neurotic whim.
Yeah. Have you guys had any experiences with good or bad leader characters? I mean, half gaming stories that we could mention?
I think I've had experiences where a leader is what I call the part-time leader. You know, they start out really good going and such, and, you know, it's like, okay, we'll go with that plan, or I think we should do this. And then you kind of look to them, and then they're just like...
The fear, every time I play a game that's got to have a leader, the fear that people are quickest to express is that the leader is going to be Hitler. Yeah. But the end result I've seen more often than not. In fact, I believe I have never seen the dictatorial leader. Mm-hmm. I have only seen the do nothing leader.
Yeah.
The leader who gets into the position and then becomes too timid, is afraid to hurt feelings. Or whose
initial plan doesn't survive impact, and then they're left a stuttering mess.
Yeah, exactly.
Or to them, it was just a title, a privilege, an ego thing, where that's the kind of leader I hate. It's like, I've got to be leader, I'm going to fight for it, I'm going to expend all this political capital,
and then sit back
and like, I'm the leader.
Now, if there's a character who's built like that, like a Gaius Baltar figure who crusades day and night against Rosalind, takes power and then just sits around with drugs and a big old oil painting of himself and women, that's cool.
Yeah that's
make sure
neat.
It's a character.
Precisely.
In fact, there was a game where I played, actually,
to make sure everybody in the party's in on it too.
Over the Waffle House the next day, hey, I'm playing a dick.
So you're not surprised, and don't get angry at me.
That's the intention. One of the few games where I was a player, and I was playing multiple characters. It was a Transformers game. They were a merger. The five of them could form one bigger robot, and they were part of a team.
Aw, you were Megazord.
One head.
And the leader was a do-nothing. He was this timid, quiet do-nothing. And I would have these arguments between within the group where they would constantly be crucifying this guy because he wouldn't lead. But what's going to, like John's
describing, you need to have your Starscream.
But like, yeah, exactly. But like John's describing, that was the intention. You know, that wasn't a failing on the part of the character design. You know, that was the intention.
People are laughing or appropriately cringing as the camera focuses on these characters.
Right, exactly.
You know what I have seen, and that your Starscream reference remind me, I have seen one person is supposed to be the leader, but they have the authority, but they're the do-nothing. And then there's
the usurper guy.
Well, not even the usurper, but somebody who's under them who doesn't necessarily want to be leader, but they're the do things guy.
That was how the castle game folded out. Unless I'm incorrect, you gave Phil the throne.
Yes.
Because you knew someone was going to put his fist up his butt and start using him as a puppet.
Yeah, exactly.
And
you did. And it was also that I knew that Phil wouldn't do anything with it necessarily. So, and it was too much authority because the person who was the king could say, "You're dead." And then the guards, because there's an army, and the guards would come in and take him and kill him. And Phil wouldn't do that. So that's why I did. Whereas you would.
Well, you know.
No, I wouldn't do it without provocation and really good roleplay reason. But I'd more than likely do it to myself.
There does come up another question. Is what do you do? And this is really maybe a GM issue, but I think mostly a player issue. If you're the leader and someone within the party does not in any way, shape, or form respect your authority,
then they become the obnoxious, pointless, outcast character who must die.
And, well, oh my God.
But, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, your options are...
I hate that character so much.
Your options are, all of them, tied up in negative political capital. If you have this person thrown in the brig, and for the next 2 hours of the game, or the next two games...
You lock them in the bathroom during the gaming session, and they all hear it through the door.
The point is...
come on, who hasn't done that?
The point is that all they can do... they sit there and twiddle their thumbs because they've been put in lockup for what they did. That's going to piss off not a character, but a player. Or if you have the person stripped of their rank or stripped of some major privileges or whatever, you run the risk. That's once again, that's not going to create hurt feelings between characters. That's going to create hurt feelings between players. And that's one of the things
times when you say, yes, it is, but it's not my fault.
Yeah.
I'm just the executor of the law.
You know, I've had
He became the dickhole outcast character. Now he's got to make his...
I've had that happen through bad GMing. Not even through action of my own, but, you know, where the party gets separated because the GM separates the party or doesn't even try and hold the party together. And it's like you have one guy wandering off into... And that was me in this case, who wandering off into danger land while the rest of the party's off safe doing something together, and I'm getting my ass handed to me, and then they're like, oh, we're having so much fun, and we're getting all this spotlight, and we're doing all this stuff, and I'm like, can I please get back to them? Like, well, no, not really. See, they're on the map, you're here. It's like,
So, you know, with all this discussion that we've had about this whole leadership role, and I think we've highlighted on some problems, some pitfalls, and whatever else here, I guess my question is, sort of around the table discussion, do we need to be in situations where we have like leaders in the party? I mean, can we just role play without having to say you're going to be the leader?
I think for me,
most of my role playing experience has basically been in a sort of a leaderless party or more of a consensus party, like you were talking about. I've never been in that experience where, especially like what we've just talked about here, where somebody is in charge and, you know, there are repercussions for this, that, and the other. I don't think I would enjoy that.
I'm the reverse. I played more games where we needed a leader. But yeah. I guess it also goes back to the
fact that...
I think
a party of Pats could work on perfect consensus. I think a party of Johns and a party of Chads wouldn't even get to the Game Master's house.
And, you know, that being said, I played a Paladin, so yeah, I was sort of a de facto leader. But even in that, I guess I was more of a... I wasn't a strong leader type. I wasn't imposing my will over the other players because... I just, you know, just for the situations like the rest of the party. Now, the rest of the party weren't all members of my faith. If they were, then I'd be like, yeah, we're going to go do this. But, you know, I was one of...
You had to butter them up to convert them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That kind of a thing. So, you know, it had to be more of a diplomacy. I was a diplomatic leader as opposed to a screw you, get in line, we're going to go do this.
I think in my case, where it mostly comes from is the fact that my background is in so many military games. Mm-hmm. The very first role-playing game I played was Star Trek. That was followed by Shadowrun, where you really didn't need a leader. You needed a contact person for the jobs and such, but not really a leader. But then that was followed by Battletech.
Yeah.
And then from Battletech, you know, we played some games like D&D where you really didn't need a leader in most cases. You know, we played some games like Robotech and Rifts and such. And some of those, it depended on what was going on. But a lot of those were pseudo-military as well. And so somebody had to carry the officer's badge.
Sure. And see, I never did those. I never did the military.
And a lot of the games I've been in required a leader. And I think one of the things you can do, backing up kind of a thought, to head off some of the drama that can create is when you're at that group template stage and you're kind of setting up that contract between the players and the GM of what there's going to have to be, you just got to make a requirement. Look, somebody's going to have to be in command. And I think how you pick a leader, we should talk about that here in a second, but somebody's going to be in command and we go through some kind of process and we arrive at who that person's going to be. And you just tell everyone else, look, it is an expectation that your character is going to have to be loyal enough to either this person or to the organization, one of the two, that you're going to do what this person says. Doesn't mean you have to always like it. Doesn't mean you can't argue with them on the side. That's great role playing. That kind of tension is really neat. Yeah. But in the end, this is not going to spill out of the game and onto the couch.
Yeah.
That this is not going to become a player versus player
issue. Or even in-game. Like if you're talking about a military thing, we'll use the Star Trek example. The captain tells you to do X and you say no.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, mate, it's Star Trek. Everybody loves each other and they're not on a military ship. They're on a science vessel. So maybe you can get away with saying no a couple of times. But in the end, at the end of the day, you have to do X. I mean, right. You have to. You're in the military. So it's either X or the brig.
Oh, right. There can always be mutiny.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's when you need to run a Warhammer 40K game and have a GMPC field marshal with a revolver ready to blow your head off at the slightest sight of cowardice.
Oh, heretic. Bam. Yeah.
And even if it's a non-military game, even if it's just something where you decide, look, our D&D adventuring party, we just want to have someone who's kind of the tiebreaker, the decision maker. Once again, tell people that up front that, look, this is an expectation that... It's not to say you're this guy's bootlick, but you are going to you are going to respect the position this person has at least most of the time. And if you don't.
And he has his own politics to attend to.
Right.
I mean, a crappy captain will go down.
And if you don't, then here are the consequences that you can expect. And I think that's going to vary from group to group, because in some groups, there are groups that really love games with a lot of conflict and they keep it in the game. And it doesn't affect their friendships or spill over to hurt feelings. And in such cases, you know what? Maybe that chaos is okay and maybe it's appropriate. But if you're dealing with a group where somebody's feelings are going to get hurt, which has been the majority of gaming groups I've been in, then these are the kinds of things you got to talk about. We talked about earlier the different kinds of people, leadership types, and we talked about some of the negative ones. But when you actually sit down as a GM, and you've got a game where you've decided you're going to pick somebody to be in that leadership role, how do you do it? Do you just pick someone? Do you let the players discuss it amongst themselves?
I just throw it out there. I just say, okay, who owns the ship? And typically someone will say, well, I do, or, well, we do. And I'll run that by the group. I'll say, okay, what's your character concept? Well, it's a droid. Well, it's a politician. Okay. So you're the smuggler. You own the ship. Great. It works for everyone's character concept. We're going forward. I don't typically just point and click and say, you're the leader.
I'm actually kind of on the reverse end of that I would like to do it your way, that I would like to go by consensus to effectively let the group elect their own president. But I found that in too many of the groups...
Well, I don't have elections. I just throw it out and wait for someone to proclaim themselves emperor and go forward.
Fair enough. But the point is that I don't... allow any kind of a populist interjection, because the problem that I found is that the gaming groups I have, too often, either
there is more than one hothead or bruisable vag
exactly or okay. There's one person where,
please tell me I am not the bruisable vag.
You're not the bruisable
I will totally take hothead over
you're
that.
Not even the hothead.
Oh cool.
You're only in character. You're an ideal candidate vis-a-vis this particular aspect of gaming. You're terrible in many other places.
Oh, well, thank
you. But for this, I have no worries.
But, you know,
also, you're always the GM. So, yeah.
Or conversely, you have someone who's always the freaking leader. And as a result, you end up going back to that super archetype thing. Yeah. They are always playing the same damn character.
Well, or they're always playing the same archetype within the archetype, right. the meta thing, which we talked about is not necessarily a bad thing. Tex, playing the same guy over and over again is bad, but
Tex was like that.
Yeah.
He's a very intelligent guy. When you're sitting in a room with him, he's not loud. He's not, you know, he doesn't have a big screaming voice, but he's the kind of person that when he speaks, generally people listen to him. And because he's got the intellect and, quite frankly, just the raw luck to back up the crazy stuff he does. The first many years of our gaming group, everything we did, he was always the leader.
Yeah.
And you know,
he was also always the oldest. And
yeah. And
you know, when you're a teenager, that actually makes a difference. 15-year-olds look up to 16, 17-year-olds.
And so the end result, though, was that, you know,
I didn't look up to you when I was 16 and you were 26 when we met.
No. Well, you did because I'm taller, but that's not it.
Now you just look up to Theodore Roosevelt.
I've never viewed you as a teenager.
Viewed you as old.
You know,
I viewed you as old, but
okay, that's fair.
Yeah. So John comes over a little bit early. He's coming in from Columbia. So for those of you who don't know the geography of this area, it's about 90 minutes to 2 hours. Well, the way John drives, it's probably 3.5 hours.
Hey, blow me. I went 80 all the way. So, unless you're an officer of the law, in which case I went illegal 70.
But it's a fairly good haul. So he makes the trip and turns out he's going to get in a little bit early. So he comes over and I hadn't had a chance to get ready or anything. So, you know, we just kind of BS'd around for a little bit and I was going to go take my shower. I said, hey, you know, rather than just pacing the house, if you want to do something more interesting, here's the remote if you want to watch TV. And so I go take my shower, come out, and I see the TV. And what do I see in the lower right-hand corner? A&E.
What is going on the screen?
Now, in all fairness, it turns out
the Sarah Connors are being mowed down one by one before Linda Hamilton realizes what goes on and goes into hiding.
Yeah, in all fairness, he was watching Terminator, but nonetheless, he picked probably the third most old man channel.
If you're crying at me because I saw the Terminator on your satellite TV preview thing and checked the watermark on the screen and thought, oh, I can't watch A&E, then
no. I'm just saying before I knew.
John, you are the youngest old man I've ever met.
Here's the thing, though.
I think.
And Chad, this time I'm going to look to you. If I had not known it was Terminator, not found out it was Terminator, should it have surprised me that John would have been watching A&E?
Not in Liza,
which is probably
least.
The third most old man channel behind maybe Hallmark and Turner Classics.
Turner Classics has some good stuff.
Just as long as he stays away from Lifetime, I think we're okay.
I have not gone to Lifetime.
I
already know
cable.
That men want to hurt me.
Every man wants to hurt you.
That's right. You're a bad Lifetime man.
I'm a potential rapist because I have a penis. Well, that's a great note to end the show. I think my popularity will no doubt soar now that I've returned.
I sure will.
Let's take this from the other end. You're the fall.
I like digging. I'm sorry.
Wow,
that was the rowdiest thing you've ever said on the mic.
On the mic,
in my presence.
Oh no, not on. Yeah, maybe in your presence.
The issue here with Pat is not that Pat is this timid, quiet.
He self-censors. That's the problem.
The problem is you should. I was talking to John about when he came over here. Was I was like, Pat is a completely different person on Sunday.
We were bickering about
him. He's boisterous.
Your death.
He's humorous. He's oftentimes crass.
Most often.
But when you're sitting here on the mics, you suddenly turn into like this little sheep, like I'm a nun about to whack you with a ruler.
That's true.
That's why I think we need to start getting you drunk or high or something before we record these episodes. So you'll cut loose. Perhaps regret what you said the next day, but then you'll have broken that cherry. And then next time,
the thing is,
you'll be
you'll
ready to go.
Regret it immediately because you'll think you made a mistake, but then you'll see what glory and honor it brings you, and you'll be happy you did, and you'll do it again in the future.
Two people will write you really angry emails, while 20 people on the forums will tell you that they were laughing their ass off at work and spitting out coffee on their computer screen, and then you'll be like, damn, I should do that more often.
That's true. Yeah, I you're right. I need to break out of the mold. I'm sort of in work mode, like you'd say, and not intentionally. I don't think because I am like you said on the whole Sunday my Sunday mode. That's what I want to be in. I think it's just trying to, you know, get a break an edge word or word, get a word in edgewise with Chad over here.
Yeah,
that's right.
You're
that's
not right. going to do it unless you just start talking.
I know.
Yeah.
Yep. I
know.
There's only frontal assault. Chad that's is true. Like the Soviet. Mm-hmm. He understands only force.
I'm going to bring my toolbox next time. So I've got a whole,
that's why John took
screwdriver.
Yeah.
The helmet and the Winston Churchill shirt.
This is a screwdriver gap. We've got a.
John is impervious to bullets right now.
I have the weapons and the armor.
And the will.
If only my shirt were not caught on this chair.
Oh, snap.
Okay, it's
all right. So,
now.
John, I have a question for you.
Lay on.
If Winston Churchill and Theodore Roosevelt were running against each other in an election,
Churchill,
who would you vote for?
Churchill was born in Britain and is not a citizen. I'd vote for Roosevelt.
But let's say it was like some imaginary country. Like we needed a president of the Atlantic Ocean.
What? Okay. Well, Churchill.
He was a Navy man. Yes. Churchill was a Navy man.
Was he?
Yes.
I thought he hated the Navy. I thought he called it like, you know, whips he was and buggery the, or something
I'm
like
sure
that.
He did, but okay. He was a Navy man.
You people are going after all the tertiary things here to dodge the central question.
I am not dodging the
central
question.
I'm asking you to pick a favorite world leader.
There's a cigar named after Churchill.
Yeah.
Well, Roosevelt shot Buffalo.
Roosevelt's is good, but he beat Cuba. Whereas,
well, he beat the Spaniards.
Whereas Churchill beat the Nazis. That's a little more impressive.
Yeah. Impressive. I have to give him that.
Well, you know, Stalin also beat the Nazis. And I don't think you would vote for Stalin.
Crappy tank years and freezing weather beat the Nazis.
Stalin beat the Russians.
And General Winter beat the Nazis and beat Napoleon and beat dozens of others. So
pseudo historical babble. We're the nerds.
Nerds.
I have a bachelor's degree. Y'all can bow down.
I have a bachelor's degree too. I have a bachelor's,
a bachelor of science. I'm a bachelor of arts.
I think you're
in history.
Arts, you liberal artist.
Yeah, one of each.
I have a bachelor's of arts and a bachelor's of science.
Really?
Whoa!
I have a bachelor's of arts in mathematics and physics, and a bachelor's of science in electrical engineering.
Damn. There's an electrical engineer with a master's in my law class.
You know what?
Why are you here? You're smarter than this.
I don't understand. I know a lot of people. This doesn't need to be on the mic. Well, a lot of people at work, you know, they've got their engineering degree. They're going back to school like to do masters. I'm like, why?
Well,
like a master's in engineering.
I mean, that's like nothing. I worked for a grocery store, and I cannot tell you the number of people I met who were either bottom rung management or normal line workers like me who had degrees.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking like degrees in philosophy and underwater basket weaving, although
I wish I would have got philosophy instead of poli-sci. Poli-sci sucks. Mm. Children, go philosophy instead.
But you have to take philosophy further. You have to
use that to get a master's, because otherwise you'll be working at great places like McDonald's.
Well, no, go to law school after. Duh.
Yeah.
Do what I do.
That's the answer to everything.
Yeah, do what John does. Vote for Winston Churchill when he runs against Roosevelt in 2008.
For president of the Atlantic. They're going to build and
somebody's got to be. It's freaking huge. Somebody's got to be in charge of it.
Freaking huge.
It's a great uncommanded area. It's a leaderless party.
It's pretty. Well, except for those Somali pirates.
I think
Somali
the tonnage
pirates.
Of our Navy equals the tonnage of like the next 20 combined.
Wow. Either we have really big ships, a lot of ships, or really fat sailors.
Probably some of each.
You know, speaking of education, how has your education impacted your role playing?
It's given me lots of good Nazi names to name my Germanic characters.
I went to technical college, so.
You've never found at any point that you nitpick some part of the game because of the scenario you're an expert in, like, man, computers don't work like
that. How often in a role playing game do you, you're either in the ancient past, no computers, or you're in the far future where the technology doesn't apply anymore?
I ask this because, like, there was a thread running as of the recording of the show on the Fear the Boot forums, where some guy's trying to work up a sci-fi universe, and they're getting into all kinds of, you know, well, this is how physics works and things like that.
Physics.
I didn't study physics. I went to a technical
college. Well, I know, but my point being, though,
it's fantastic.
Like, for example, Tex did this to me all the time. That Tex had a degree in engineering, and he knew a huge amount. He was very well educated in the area of his expertise, and you know, he could sit there and talk his way through all kinds of stuff, and it definitely affected his playing. And if I described something too over the top wrong, he would not hesitate to call me on that. Do you find your education affects
I would say yes, I've had that experience in the fantasy genre, just be because some things would come up, like you said there. I have participated in the typical geekery of trying to basically figure out and calculate falling damage, because, you know, you get into this silliness of like one system says that, oh, you take a D6 damage for every 10 feet you fall, which is utter ridiculousness, because, you know, somebody can fall, literally they can fall 10 feet and die, and you're saying, oh, it's a scratch.
Well, you can so take you, six you can damage and die if you're a commoner or a house
well,
cat.
Well, that's true, but like if you're, you know, yeah, if you're a player, it's, you know, it's just different. So there's that.
Dude,
but
you can take your little toothpick sword and kill the dragon. It's D&D, man.
I know, and exactly. That's why I say it's right. The typical geekery of, you know, it's just overanalyzing it. Same thing, you know, like the DMs threw out something where there's this big, huge, you know, iron net, and, you know, what will destroy it? Will dragon breath do it, or whatever else? And you're talking, you know, about the properties of this, that, and the other. So yeah, I've had some interjection in there from science.
One of the things I've nitpicked before, and it actually has nothing to do with an education. Mike ran a D&D game, and he had these monks attack us, and he's like, oh, they had staffs. I'm thinking, well, what kind of staff? And when I asked the question, I was thinking, was it like a long, you know, big Robin Hood quarterstaff, or was it a beat stick, basically, mm-hmm. a club? And he said, oh, no, they're the big long staffs, and they're made of stone. I'm like, because in his mind, when, you know, when he said it in his mind, because he's just thinking quick on the fly, he's like, oh, well, they're big staffs, so they'll do more damage. And how can they do more damage? We'll make them out of rock, because that's heavier than wood. And right. It's just like, that will never work. And I spent like 20 minutes trying to explain to him why that would never work. The other big geek out argument I got into, and I should have just never gotten, I should have just let it ride. And because it was a long argument, and it actually kind of got some blood boiling on both sides. It's an argument I had with Phil. Phil believed that there was sound in space. Because he based it,
Phil believes a lot of things,
because he completely based it on all the movies he's seen. It's not like he slept through a physics class or something. It was just based on movies, and I was just like, no, there isn't sound in space. I just was like explaining it to him. And
you don't even want to breach the subject that there really is not an explosion in a vacuum either.
No, there isn't.
Don't even go there.
That does drive me nuts watching movies.
Laser beams don't have recoil.
Yeah.
Oh, well, no.
Laser beams also wouldn't generally be visible.
The only thing that I could say about that is that you can make a laser beam visible, but it wouldn't look like a slow moving bolt.
No, that, you know, and it would be boom on off, and it would be contiguous.
Yeah. And if you were making a weapon, you would, I mean, I could laser pointers and stuff. I can understand why you would have a laser weapon in reality that had a colored beam. So you can kind of track it,
mm-hmm.
but I will tell you
you can terrify the hapless targets.
Sure. Yep. But yeah, generally it would be invisible, but I'll say about that, what a friend of mine who was in Iraq said about tracer rounds, because we were talking about weapons and stuff in Iraq, and he said, oh yeah, we got the tracer rounds in, and we would pull out, cause it's like every fifth round or so, we'd pull out the tracers and replace them with bullets. I'm like, well, why would you do that? Doesn't it help you aim at night and stuff? No, it tells the enemy where you are.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's not the good thing you want there. So
that's true.
But this guy got he got a bronze star, I think it was, because they had a fire base in Iraq, and they had a minefield set up, and they had like, the fortifications and whatnot. And they got intelligence that the enemy was coming to hit them in the middle of the night. So he was a sergeant, and he, without orders or anything, took his squad, and they moved out into the minefield. They laid the minefield so they knew where all the mines were, I'd want to do anyway. Led them through the minefield and set up a hidden firing position on the other side of the wire in the minefield and everything. So when the enemy, they pulled up, and they're getting out of their trucks, they're getting ready to set up, and then my friend and his squad hit them and wiped them out before they even could like mount any kind of defense, and chased him off, and he got bronze star for
awesome.
It. Yeah.
It's badass.
Mm-hmm.
I probably would have given him one just for setting it up in a minefield.
Yeah.
There's another one along those lines. My experience with guns.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always things in role-playing games drive me nuts in that regard.
Yeah.
Because I definitely get the idea. The vast majority of role-playing game writers have not fired a whole lot of guns in their lives.
Yeah. Well, and you see that in a lot of things. Like, I think Hollywood movies try to get guns right because the stuntmen and stuff who handle the guns, the weapons master stuff, know how guns operate, but then the directors usually don't. And so there's this sort of kind of getting it right, kind of not. You see a lot, if you watch a lot of anime is kind of military based, or at least genres of it is, they never get the guns right. Well, that's because there's gun laws in Japan that nobody has any guns. They've never touched a gun. But there's another anime, Ghost in the Shell, where they took the entire production team to Fiji and they fired guns. They had all kind of pistols, fully automatic weapons, shotguns and stuff. And they fired all the guns. I want
to go to Fiji and fire a bunch of guns.
And they shot different things. They shot wood, they shot stone, they shot metal to see what it looked like when you shot it and stuff. And if you watch the original Ghost in the Shell movie, it's very cool how they do it, you know, and how, and like all the gun stuff is hyper accurate, except for one sci-fi gun at the end, but that's beside the point.
Where do you draw the line? And then what I mean by that is I think we all accept that role-playing games have to have some basis in reality, because otherwise...
But cool factor is still cool?
Well, cool factor is still cool, and on top of that, the pedantics of getting every detail right and every arguing every little physics equation and every little truth, quite frankly, just drags down the game in really stupid details, like the lightsabers in Star Wars. I mean, it's ridiculous, but nonetheless,
but they're cool.
And yeah. So as long as no one embarrasses themselves by trying to explain them.
And there's the Force right there.
Yeah.
Making fun of your efforts to criticize lightsabers.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, that's perfectly fine. You know, we just accept that and let it go. But at the same time, if we watched a movie where one of the characters just flapped his arms and flew away, everyone in the theater would be like,
"Well,
what the bleep," and walk out. Where in a role-playing game should you draw that line between...
Internal consistency is the only rule.
I think internal consistency is big. You know, it's like, if you flap your arms and fly away, everybody should be able to flap their arms and fly away.
Or at least you cast the appropriate fly spell to be able to do it.
Yeah, yeah. There doesn't have to be an explanation, but it has to be consistent. You know, I think that's a difficult line to walk, is that, especially with magic, I don't want magic explained to me, because then you get into the whole thing, force is cool, force is crazy, then you get midichlorians, and it's like, oh, come on. But, yeah, I want it to be consistent, and, you know, if it fails for a consistent reason, even if I don't know what that reason is. And if it works for a reason, a consistent reason, even if I don't know what that reason is. As a person who runs a game, though, this is what I want from my players. If I make mistakes in reality and even consistency, if it's a little thing, I don't want to hear about it. I'm trying to run the game. I'm trying to go, and I catch the little mistakes that I make as I'm running the cyberpunk game. I had a guy shoot you with a gun that blasted you across a table. Shouldn't have done that. But I was kind of going, I was in the moment and it looked cool and I was just popping. You didn't call me on it.
Exactly.
And because it was like, who cares? And right, we're in the moment. Yeah. And you know, you want to bring that up afterwards. That's cool. If it's a glaring, huge, gigantic mistake, especially if the mistake in reality is going to screw over the players, then that's fine. Then you stop the game.
Be careful, though. The game master can be screwing with your perceptions because there's some sort of trickery going on.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a player will halt the game and say, "No, there can't be two shots. There's only one guy." And the GM could say, but there were two shots. What do you think happened? What do you think's going on? And they won't get it. They'll just scream about how you broke the rules.
I would definitely say, per Chaz's example, pick your battles.
Mm-hmm.
That you as a player, I mean, don't be a douche and just sit there.
And don't give the game master a pass, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, but pick your battles. I mean, don't be a douche. And every time he says something, because I've been in games with guys where they just want to freaking argue everything. And half the time, to be honest, some of them didn't even know what the hell they were talking about. But nonetheless, they felt something was true and they were just going to argue everything. And it just was not freaking worth it. But there are other times where, yeah, that it really does matter to the game, or it matters to your success at a particular plan or idea, or there's something so huge that, yeah, that the plot hinges on it, or your idea hinges on it, and maybe it is worth arguing about. But I think in the end, there's got to be some give and take, where the game master maybe has to be willing to admit sometimes they're wrong And sometimes the players have to admit or be willing to accept either I'm wrong, or even if I'm right and I know I'm right and Wikipedia says I'm right, that I'm just going to let this ride because, quite frankly, having a fun game is more important than being right.
And, of course, be tactful if you must make a correction. There's nothing like showing up the GM in the middle of the game and stopping it to do so to make him love you forever.
Right.
Yeah, I think definitely respect that GM authority. I mean, you know, or call it what you will, but just like you said.
Yeah.
Think how you would want to be objected to if you were running the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because of the, it's a big responsibility.
Because you can always have a really fun night, and then at the end of the night, because our advice on Fear the Boot is talk about the game after you're done with the game. Just don't say the game's over and everybody goes home. Mm-hmm. Talk about what you like, what you didn't like, and bring that up. Brain's like, you know, hey, cars can't do that. You know, or this doesn't work like this, or in this period of time, you know, it's like, oh, we're playing Roman times and, you know, you have guys charging into people with lances. Did you know that they didn't have stirrups back then and they couldn't do the charge? And that's kind of blah, 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 blah. Look at me. I'm a huge history nerd. You can have a fun night. You can talk about it later. In the next game, it can be retconned. You know, maybe not too much or not, or, as you know, and not, maybe, you know, something, I mean, can be worked out.
Maybe the GM wants to run a game that's not that accurate, and that's the type of game they want. I was in
maybe
a game.
It doesn't matter. Exactly. I mean, what we'll if say, the Roman no chased thing. You down on his light cavalry with a horse as opposed to crush you with a lance charge?
Yeah.
Does it matter? Yeah. Probably not.
You still got a piece of metal sticking out of your head. Yeah. So
there was a game I was playing in where I asked the GM, because there's a bunch of guys, it was a sci-fi game, they're shooting some kind of energy weapon at me. And of course, I'm trying to think, you know, well, gee, how can I deal with this energy weapon? So I asked him, I said, what exactly is it they're shooting at me? And he said, special effect number 4.
Yes. And, you know, he made that, not an excuse, but he made that comment. That was like one of his favorite comments, because he ran fantasy sci-fi. So it was like really hard sci-fi with magic and craziness, sort of like anime, I guess. And whenever we asked him, he gave us that answer, and it's like, that's totally acceptable.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, that's fine.
He was going for movie cool.
Yeah.
And it's like, we just
came
to accept
that. He's not going to hear you say, oh, it's a laser? Well, I get a mirror out.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So.
Cool is cool. I'm cool with cool. No, there's no but with that. I am fine with cool. It's just. Make it consistent.
Right.
You know, if I hold up a trash can lid, that situation, special effect number 5, and I do some really cool thing, I hold up a trash can lid, hits it, and nothing happens, I save myself, that's fine. Make it to where every time I hold up the trash can lid, it's stopping the bolt, the energy, or whatever.
You know, keep it, improve that weapon.
Until they improve the weapon.
Yeah. To actually
special effect
to,
number 6.
To be
6.
Able to go through a trash can lid, which
that's
is
right.
A very, very tough thing to get
trash
through,
can
I know.
Piercing rounds.
Yeah. Right.
All right, well, I guess let's go ahead and wrap this one up before I totally lose my voice. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time when hopefully I have a little bit better tenor. So we will catch you then.
See ya.
Later.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.